coming up on Path to Zero.
The growth of artificial intelligence, as well as the transition to clean energy, those are two of the most important drivers of economic activity in the world today.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. In this episode, we're going to talk about AI's growing energy footprint, how to make data centers more sustainable, and clean energy innovation with David Sandalo. David's the inaugural fellow at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy and a former senior official at the U.S. Department of Energy, the State Department, and the White House. He's also the chair of the Innovation for Cool Earth Forum, or ICEF, Roadmap Project, which recently released a major report on sustainable data centers. He's one of the world's leading experts on energy technology and climate policy, and he also hosts the podcast AI, Energy, and Climate, which explores how artificial intelligence can accelerate solutions for a cleaner future. David, really glad you could join us. I've been looking forward to this conversation, and welcome to Path to Zero.
Totally appreciate the invitation.
David, you've worked at some of the highest levels of U.S. energy and climate policy and now lead the research for Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy. What's driving the current focus around artificial intelligence and the clean energy transition?
I think that the growth of artificial intelligence, as well as the transition to clean energy, those are two of the most important drivers of economic activity in the world today. I think that the growth of artificial intelligence, as well as the transition to clean energy, those are two of the most important drivers of economic activity in the world today. And so for me, the intersection of those two is incredibly interesting, incredibly important. And it's been my privilege to study it at Columbia University. There's so much going on this. I'm delighted to kind of explore any topics related to it that you'd like to.
It's interesting to me that even though it consumes most of our news cycle right now, about 2 years ago, I don't remember, you know, intensive conversation. It's almost like it's come out of nowhere. You've released two book length reports. I mean, very detailed reports about AI and clean energy over the last 2 years. Speaking of that time frame, tell us about those and maybe what they are and where we can find them, and then, you know, what's in them.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And your first comment, yeah, it's amazing how much the attention to artificial intelligence has grown in the past 3 years. It's actually started in November 2022 when ChatGPT released its model. And I think it just caught the world by storm. People were shocked at the capabilities that it had. You know, back in the 1950s, a leading computer scientist named Alan Turing was talking about something called the Turing test. And the Turing test was a question: could you distinguish between a computer and a person in conversation? And if at the point that a computer was indistinguishable from a person, that would be a dramatic threshold in the ability of in computing capabilities. And we passed that threshold. I mean, now, and I think that capability just it's changed so many things. I'll say, as a professor, it's astonishing how much the quality of the papers in my courses have improved in the past 3 years as students are using this technology. So it is just, as you said, received enormous attention. That led me to take on the relationship between AI and energy as major projects in the past couple of years. And we've released two book-length reports, each more than 300 pages, put together by teams of more than a dozen very distinguished co-authors. And one we just released last month is called The Sustainable Data Centers Roadmap. And in that book, we look at how do you make data centers sustainable from an energy standpoint, from a water standpoint, from a greenhouse gas standpoint, from a land use standpoint, and more. And then the other one that we released is called, the name is a mouthful, it's called the AI for Climate Change Mitigation Roadmap. And we have a very simple question in that book, which is how do you use AI to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And there's lots of ways we can get into the details there. It's a very simple question. The answer consumes 334 pages. And I think it's an area that needs enormous attention in the years ahead.
Yeah, it really is amazing. Well, let's get right to it. How can we use AI to help cut emissions? Because I find for myself, you know, and again, with a focus on the United States, but an eye around the whole rest of the world, it's amazing that as we sit here today, there's seemingly a few short-term clean solutions to generate power. So even the conversation around moving to nuclear, no matter what flavor of nuclear, whether it's conventional SMR or even fusion, I mean, it's decade off, decade and a half off. Here we are turning back on coal plants, bringing back on nuclear plants. There doesn't seem to be a correlation between more AI, the power needs, and clean. So talk to us about that.
Well, let me first talk about what's happening with clean energy right now more broadly, and then get to specifically on AI, because I think I have a slightly more optimistic take than one you just offered on the role of clean energy today, and particularly with respect to solar power and wind power. The growth in solar power and the drop in the price of solar power along with storage in the past 10 to 15 years has been extraordinary. I mean, we have solar power today at, you know, less than 10%, much less than 10% actually than it was, you know, 15 years ago in terms of cost. And that's just led to massive deployment in many places around the world. I mean, what's happening in China right now is off the charts when it comes to solar and storage deployment. Some of your listeners may be familiar with these statistics, but in 2023, there was more solar power deployed in China than had ever been deployed in the history of the United States in 1 year. And then in 2024, they did it again. And then in 2025, they're doing it again. And there are these pictures of just extraordinary landscapes of China covered with cheap solar panels. And the same thing's happening with electric vehicles there, by the way. I mean, we have more than half of the new car sales in China are going to be electric, plug-in electric this year. And globally, it's about 1 in 5. So I think there's actually a lot happening on the energy transition. I agree, nuclear is a little ways off, the small modular reactors. I'm optimistic that that could be an important energy source in the 2030s, I think, but it is a ways off. And also, by the way, I think geothermal is a hugely important opportunity for us right now. And I'm delighted to see the current administration investing in both geothermal and in nuclear, really continuing policy. There aren't that many things that have bipartisan support in the United States these days, but geothermal and nuclear both do, which I'm delighted to see. So that's a little bit of a riff just on the energy transition. You asked about AI and how we could use AI to reduce emissions. In our book, which is against the AI for Climate Change Mitigation Roadmap, it's available on Amazon. You can also download it for free. If you Google those words and my name, David Sandelow, you'll be able to find it. So we look at 8 different sectors. I'll just talk quickly about 2 ways that I think AI can reduce emissions. One of them is in the power sector. We're already using AI to optimize the location of generation assets, transmission lines. There's other applications. There's so many. Let me just pick one, which is improving the use of transmission lines. Heavy-duty electric transmission lines are dangerous. Lots of electricity is obviously very dangerous. You need to be very conservative in putting electricity through transmission lines. With AI tools and modern sensors, we can dramatically increase the amount of electricity we put through transmission lines safely, and I think that can make a big difference for the power grid. Talk about this, I'll just mention one other way that I'm excited about how AI can reduce emissions, and that's in the areas of materials innovation. So, in a lot of areas in the energy transition, like battery chemistry or super strong lightweight steel for new drill bits for geothermal, we need innovation in materials. It kind of famously, 150 years ago, when Thomas Edison was inventing the modern light bulb, he spent a year testing different materials, running electricity through them to see how much heat and light would be produced to come up with what he thought was the best approach. So today we can simulate 1 million of those types of experiments in a second. And beyond just the incredible speed of doing that, we can actually test materials that don't exist in the world, simulate a simulated test. And if it looks like they'll have good properties, we can use them. We can test and see whether they do in the real world. And that just, I think, it has the opportunity to dramatically speed the pace of invention, which can help us accelerate the pace of geothermal technologies, nuclear technologies, many other technologies. I'll stop there, but I think there's all kinds of exciting opportunities for using AI for the energy transition and reducing emissions.
You know, that's a great, refreshing look. So as you talk about, we can use solar and wind. Of course, generally, a data center wants power 24/7. And so there, is your clean version to use solar wind with battery backup for the intermittent periods? Or is that, when we talk about the levelized cost and the full system, is that what you're thinking?
Yes, and I think we can also have natural gas backup. I think you can use the sun when the sun is available, back it up into batteries, and then there will be periods in many places where you need some backup, and you can use natural gas, use diesel generators if you need to. But solar can take on more and more and more of the energy needs. And that's going to have, obviously it's an environmental benefit, but more than that, it's a cost benefit. I mean, right now, I think power prices are becoming an incredibly important issue politically in the United States. And solar power can really help us bring the cost of power down. So I think it's an important approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So you talk a little bit there about kind of the issues, the intersection for data centers, AI, land use, water use, power use. I'm seeing right now kind of a movement towards data centers wanting to locate where they can get zoned, so there's kind of available land. Maybe there's a grid situation that works for them. But oddly enough, they're going to places, for me, are already really water constrained. Do you study that? I mean, to me, it's fascinating that, because there are a lot of places in this country that are already water constrained, right? The farmers or the farmer regulations have them consuming the water. What these data centers, what are they going to do for adequate water?
I'm so glad you asked this, because this is an issue that's getting a lot of attention. And we have a chapter on this in our Sustainable Data Centers Roadmap. And if people are interested, I really urge you to take a look at this. Let me just say some of the highlights. One highlight is that water use by data centers is trivial from a global standpoint, but it can be very significant locally, as you were just saying. So, and just from a global water cycle standpoint, one statistic that stuck in my mind is that that the global agriculture sector uses about 12,000 times more water than data centers do. And actually, that's 12,000 times more than data centers are projected to use in 2030 after this big growth cycle. So globally, it's not that important. But locally, it can, in a number of places, data centers have actually had very big impacts on the water table. There's some good news, though, which is that the next generation of cooling technologies for data centers are much, much better from a water use standpoint than the prior generation. And this new generation is actually necessary as these chips are using more and more power. You need new, more advanced cooling technologies to dissipate the heat from the data centers. And the new cooling technologies, direct to chip liquid cooling, some other types of technologies, are closed loop, and many of them use almost no water. On an ongoing basis. In fact, there's a big data center that's being developed by Microsoft in Wisconsin right now, and Microsoft is asserting that in some materials I've seen that the toilets and the sinks or the people use are going to use more water than the cooling technologies there. So there's, this is a real issue that requires a lot of attention, because in some places, particularly in water scarce areas like Phoenix, which is a data center hub, there can be big impacts on the water table if the right technologies aren't used. But if the right technologies are used, there's a lot of potential to make this almost a non-issue.
Interesting answer. Do you, you know, the numbers for data center growth are just astronomical, right? You see data centers being permitted or requested to be permitted or companies forming. I see numbers that range anywhere from 30 to 50 gigawatts of new demand. As you study that, do you tend to focus on kind of maybe how much power really? I mean, obviously, a lot of those data centers are redundant, right? They're trying to build three when, in fact, they might build one or two. Do you tend to think of a number in terms of new demand in the U.S., particularly from data centers?
Yeah, and that the term a lot of people are using are phantom applications. You know, people are some of these hyperscalers are putting in three or four applications, and they only expect one to be granted. So I've seen numbers in the past month or so that are in the range of 110, 130 gigawatts of new demand, real demand that's expected. I have, that's not my research, but that's research I've seen from some others. So
that's a lot higher than I've seen. That's a big number.
It's a big number.
Kind of put that in perspective. That's more than we build in new power generation over a period of a couple of years, right? I mean, that's
oh, absolutely. You know, that number is a couple of years, 110, 130. Yeah. It's an enormous number and very different than anything we've seen in the U.S. grid for the past quarter century, yeah, even more actually. So this is a dramatic change in the U.S. power sector.
We're seeing a change in the way we generate power, maybe use power because of AI and, you know, Microsoft or a bunch of the large companies, they might partner. We're seeing them bring on old nuclear plants. We're seeing them partner with a utility. Where, I don't know, 20 years ago, if you were going to build a facility, you'd go to your local power company, you'd contract for power. Do you see a model 5 years from now that will be the model, or do you think it will be a combination of data centers with their own power generation, maybe partial or full, and utilities providing some power? Or if you think about the complexities of the balancing authorities, the complexities of FERC, which again, I find make this transformation much more difficult, right? If FERC didn't exist, if you didn't have balancing authorities, it might be a lot simpler, but you have these fiefdoms and hierarchies. Clearly the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to be in a period where people who need large sums of power very well may bring their power along. But do you think that levels out and we go back to our traditional methods, or is this just how it's going to be for a long time now?
I think it'd be a combination of approaches. I don't expect there to be a large amount of purely behind the meter power going to data centers. That is with no grid connections. I think people are talking about that right now, mainly because there is the imperative for a lot of the data center developers and their customers is speed to power. That's they want to get quickly and get to operations quickly, and the interconnection queue is very long, and so they're talking about behind the meter to try to move quickly. Over the long haul, I think the reliability benefits of connecting to the grid are so important. Almost all of the data center developers are going to want to have grid connections.
You know, I'm a technologist. I love to believe in technology, innovation. I would, if I had to label you, I'd have to say you start as a researcher, a climate official, think about it that way. But, you know, you've already talked about a couple of technologies that are exciting, right? That we're going to learn to use less heat in data centers, so therefore our cooling demands are dropping. There's going to be transformation in the chips itself. Any other technology, and you've talked about, you believe in solar and wind and batteries and geothermal. Any other innovations in technology, both for data centers or for power gen, that you feel like are really exciting beyond maybe chip growth and geothermal?
One that comes to mind, Tucker, is carbon capture. And I think that has a lot of potential to make a difference in the decades ahead. You know, today it's expensive, carbon capture, but the costs are coming down. And it's an area, by the way, where AI tools can help make a difference. They can help speed the pace of innovation. And it's been interesting to me how some of the oil and gas majors are invested pretty heavily in this and doing some work on carbon capture. Look, I think the United States has such a potential to drive this technology forward. And to, I mean, I know a lot of your listeners are from the natural gas industry and it's amazing what innovation has led to in the natural gas industry in the United States in the past 25 years. I mean, the shale
absolutely amazing.
The shale revolution was extraordinary, and you know, tremendous geopolitical benefits for the United States, tremendous environmental benefits for the United States too. When we produce natural gas, we need to control methane leaks. We need to, over the long term, we're going to need carbon capture along with it as well. So I hope the same type of innovative genius and drive from our capitalistic market structure that helped to drive the shale revolution can do the same thing with carbon capture technologies, along with other technologies.
It's time for a break. We'll get back to our conversation with David Sandilo from Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy right after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. I'm talking with David Sandilo from Columbia University about how artificial intelligence and innovation are shaping the future of clean energy. So let's talk about price of electricity. Let's talk about affordability, because I think I really want your opinion on this. I know you tend to believe that over time, this increased demand from power gen for AI might in fact drive down prices. But certainly we're in a spot right now where utilities are seeing rising prices pretty significantly. I live in the PJM grid, and I'm always fearful when I see some of the pricing bids that are coming in. You would have to be fearful of that. Where do you think? You think electricity continues to increase in price for a while and then maybe levels out? Is that how you see it?
This is a very complicated story. And actually, we're just launching a major research project on this at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia. So I think I'll have better answers months or year from now as we really dive into this. But there's been some good work. And I think one headline from the research I've seen on this is that there's a lot of variation in different parts of the countries on what's driving power price increases. I think, yes, you mentioned PJM, and in PJM, the capacity auction prices were very high. Obviously, this summer got a lot of political attention. I think that was driven a lot by power demand from data centers. And so I think you can see a direct flow through from data center power demand to power price increases in PJM. In other places, we're seeing very different dynamics. I think power price increases in the West, for example, Western United States, have been driven a lot by wildfire risks. We've seen just the need to upgrade the grid, independent of kind of new demand, being an important driver of power price in some places. In Georgia, we're seeing the cost of nuclear power plants, which were way, way over budget, unfortunately, driving up power prices in the Southeast as those rate-based costs are passed through to consumers. So there's not one national story, I think, on this. I think that there's a media narrative, which is pretty simple, which is more data center power demand is driving up power prices. I think that's true in some places, not true everywhere, and this requires some more refined analysis.
I agree. That's good. I look forward to some of that analysis. All right. I know you are kind of a China expert. Had a long time to study that, and you've worked extensively, and I think written quite a bit about U.S.-China cooperation, mainly as it relates to climate. And now, how do you see the evolving relationship between China and the United States as we think about first climate? Now, do you see us being able to cooperate on some of this technology, on carbon capture techniques, for example? Is it possible that we can partner in those areas?
I think government-to-government cooperation between the U.S. and China in this area is extremely difficult, if not impossible, unfortunately. And I think that's too bad, but I think that's the reality. And obviously, under the current U.S. administration, there's not any interest in working on climate change issues. But even under the Biden administration, there were real, you know, which was very committed to trying to address climate change issues. I think the efforts to cooperate with China in this area were, they struggled to do that, I think. There were some important agreements between the U.S. and China under the Biden administration, and to give credit to the diplomats on both sides. But there is so much mutual mistrust between the U.S. and China. I think it's just very difficult to work together on technologies in any way at this stage of the bilateral relationship. I think that's a problem for the world. In an earlier era, when the U.S. and China were working together, it helped to drive progress forward. But I wish I were more optimistic about this. I just don't see it at the government-to-government level. I do think it's important in this era of strong tensions between our two countries to maintain dialogue between experts in both countries and at least some type of non-governmental interactions. And, you know, in the depth of the Cold War between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and Soviet Union, our two countries worked together on things like polio vaccines and public health issues. You know, climate change wasn't a big issue back then, but I think maintaining some type of dialogue between our two countries is really important. And look, I mean, the pace of innovation in China right now is extraordinary. What's happening is really pretty remarkable. You know, I'll tell you this striking observation for me. For decades, I've been going to China, and Chinese business executives, Chinese diplomats have been saying, we need technology transfer from the United States. You know, we need you to send us and to license us some of your most advanced technologies. Well, now we're at a point where U.S. businesses are eager to license Chinese technology because Chinese technology has become better than ours, in, for example, in battery chemistry or in battery mass production and some other areas. So if we could work together, that would be the best world. But given the mutual suspicions and the geopolitical competition between our two countries, I'm not optimistic that's going to be happening in the short or even the medium term.
Occasion to visit with Sam Altman 2 years ago, talking about some of this. And the final part of that would be the use of AI for national defense, perhaps even for war and warfare. And I think because AI can literally change your ability to own, conduct warfare, I often wonder if it will be really a catalyst for a breakdown in U.S.-China relations. Because we're both trying to do it not only for the betterment of business and for our people, but for protection, security, and perhaps even national interest if we think about taking over countries. You think about that?
Yeah, this is a very serious issue, Tucker. And this is not really my specialty, the defense security side, but this is a driver of the export restrictions that the U.S. government has imposed under both the Biden and the Trump administrations on the most advanced chips. To China. I think one more general point that relates to this is that reaching the most advanced AI is not the only important aspect of any AI competition. It's also how you implement it in your society. And what I'm hearing a lot of Fortune 500 companies saying today in different ways is we're not even yet ready to implement in our companies the types of AI that are available today. There's a lot of issues in kind of integrating it in the systems of companies. The next most advanced step matters less than just finding ways to integrate it into our systems. From some of the literature I've read, I think that's very much true in the defense structure too, that finding, making sure that we're integrating AI tools into our force structure, into DOD and the Pentagon, is incredibly important. It's not just having the most advanced technologies.
As we think about kind of natural alliances, clearly we need to work with China, but it's most likely that China will work even better with Iran, Russia, North Korea. Who do you see? Where are the centers of excellence for some of this that will partner with us? Because I find it's a shorter list as we think about our allies that are really moving forward in this technology.
The top of the list would be the UK, I think. The UK is a major center of excellence when it comes to research in this area. Some of the, some Google DeepMind, some other leaders in this space started in the UK, and there's a lot going on there. But there's also, great research in other parts of Europe and France, got Mistral and Japan as well. I think it's also interesting and important to focus on areas in the world where there's very little attention to these topics, or at least very little expertise in these topics. I think we could, there's been the term digital divide for many decades, there's a number of decades now, kind of a difference between developed world and developing world when it comes to digital technologies. There could be the AI divide could have growing importance in the years ahead. And it's an important topic to pay attention to.
Yes, great point. All right, well, then last question along that line. You've also talked a lot about supply chain and resiliency in the supply chain. Do you think we're doing better there? Obviously, we've made a lot of leaps, I guess, around rare earths, at least in terms of our negotiations with China. But supply chain in general, are we moving on the right path now?
I think we're moving in the right direction, but not nearly fast enough. And I think the dynamic we saw in the past month or two with respect to rare earths is a bit sobering in that regard. I mean, President backed off of some of his, demands or some of China, it seems in substantial part because of Chinese government's very substantial leverage related to exports of rare earths. There's been a, there's been attention to this for years in the U.S. That is attention to improving the resilience of our supply chains for rare earths and a lot of other things. I think we need to put that on steroids in a way that we haven't so far. And that means a lot of innovative government tools guaranteeing purchases of some of these things over the long term, supporting accelerated permitting. And then very critically, working with allies. This is not going to happen. Resilience of supply chain is not going to happen solely based upon domestic production. We need to work with close allies. And so respecting the importance of traditional alliances and building up those relationships, making the United States a trusted and reliable ally with traditional allies, I think that's a huge part of the solution. This problem, I don't think we've been going in the right direction recently on that. And I think it's very important to focus on that aspect of the solution to this problem.
Yeah, great answer. Thank you. You've got your own podcast, AI, Energy, and Climate. What kind of conversations do you have there, and how do people find your podcast?
Tucker, thanks for the plug. I really appreciate it. You can find our AI, Energy, Climate podcast on all major places where podcasts are distributed, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on YouTube. For me, this has been new. I've learned from people like you, Tucker. I've been a podcast host now for about 9 months, 10 months, and I've had the privilege of having wonderful guests. There are some very high-profile guests, including Jensen Huang, CEO of NVIDIA, of course, Jennifer Granholm, Secretary Biden's Energy Secretary, some real leaders from the financial sector, including Bill Brown and others, and we explore different aspects of the relationship between AI, energy, and climate issues. So if you're interested in those issues, please listen to us at the AI, Energy, and Climate podcast.
Yeah, I would encourage people to listen. It's a really fun format and a little different than most podcasters use. I'd recommend a listen, AI, Energy, and Climate. All right, we like to have a little fun as we start wrapping up. And we start with a really important question. I'm going to hand you a magic wand in just a moment. And you can use that wand one time over the next 1 year to make a change that you think in the energy world would have the most impact. David, how would you use your magic wand?
I love the question. Wouldn't that be nice, Tucker?
It would be nice.
I would like to restore a respect for science to the highest levels of the U.S. government. You know, I think America is such a great country, and one of the reasons we're such a great country is because of our incredible scientific discoveries and establishment. I mean, you know, we're the country that invented the transistor, the internet, we put a man on the moon, and so much more. Our universities are, you know, jewels, that, and people from around the world want to come to U.S. universities. And I think that's been the result of a strong support, close connection between our government and universities and the scientific establishment over the course of many years. I really worry that that's been lost. We see attacks on universities, huge budget cuts. In September, we saw the president stand before the United Nations and attack the kind of consensus science on climate change in very political kind of rhetorical terms. And I was abroad a lot in October, and I can tell you that speech got attention. And there's a narrative in Europe I've seen and Asia that the United States is in decline. And I spent a lot of my time pushing back against that narrative, saying, no way. This is a great, dynamic, strong country. We are not in decline. But I think a speech like that, that it confirmed people's around the world, it confirmed people's perception in that regard. So I'd love to have a magic wand and be able to just wave it and say, within the top levels of the U.S. government, we have a deep, abiding respect for science and for America's contribution to science.
Great use of the magic wand. Thank you. One other fun tradition we have is we love to plant a tree in a national forest in recognition of your time with us, the expertise you've shared with us. Do you have a favorite forest where you like to have your tree planted?
Well, it's going to be somewhere in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan. So I grew up in Michigan, and I learned to
beautiful love, spot.
I love to learn the outdoors when I was a teenager in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, which is, I tell you, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. And it's incredible how sparsely populated and visited it is. And the Porcupine Mountains, the Lake of the Clouds, it's not a national forest. I think it's a state park. There's Ottawa National Forest, I think, is in the Upper Peninsula. There's the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, but it would be somewhere in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan. And if you haven't visited there, and don't know it, anybody listening, it's an amazing place. I really recommend it. It's got stunning natural beauty.
It's an awesome place, and we'll first try for your state park, and if we're not able to do it, we'll get to the National Forest. It's a beautiful spot. So one last question for you as we wrap up. So much going on in your world, your writings, your research, the work at Columbia in general, and specifically the Center for Global Energy Policy. How can our listeners learn more? What do you want to tell them that we haven't talked about today about the work that's going on there?
Well, first, Tucker, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. So I really appreciate you touching on such a wide range of topics. Please visit our website at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Please sign up for or listen to my podcast, the AI Energy and Climate Podcast. My colleagues at Columbia have another great podcast in this area called the Columbia Energy Exchange. I recommend listening to Columbia Energy Exchange. And if you're interested in these AI energy climate connections, I also recommend looking for the Sustainable Data Centers Roadmap. Google that in my name, and you'll David Sandalo, and you'll find it. And then the AI for Climate Change Mitigation Roadmap. You'll find both of them, and I hope they'll be useful resources for you.
Well, there's so much going on in your area of research with data centers, with clean climate. Look forward to visiting with you again. But for today, thanks so much, David, for being our guest on Path to Zero.
Tucker, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Path to Zero. If you enjoyed our discussion, please subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast app or YouTube. You can also find our interviews and more insights on Substack at pathtozero.substack.com. We'll see you next time.